to assume that sort of responsibility. On the other hand, I know too that you are going to be facing the consideration of simply an in-out decision by the judge. And on this, I simply feel that even if you institute that sort of a proposal, that there are certain factors which are better decided at the judicial level, particularly with respect to the matrix, criminalist use assessment score, crime severity ratings, in essence, factors which will determine the actual amount of time to be served. And then, of course, aggravation and mitigation. The parole board, and at least those of us on the commission, feel that it is better served to be done in an adversarial setting. I feel it can be done. I have done it now for approximately 5 years. I don't pretend to have the number of criminal cases that they have in some jurisdictions, but if you compare my caseload, in essence, I have as heavy a schedule as anyone in the state. And in essence, I'm simply saying that even if you go that particular way and depart from the task force proposal, I would like to still see the judges forced to share in that sort of decision-making process which affects those sort of time considerations, because I think it's better done before the trial court and before the parole board. And I simply think the public is better served, and that it is, at least from my view, it's sort of, so far as the judge is my view, we don't want it all, or we don't want anything, and neither approach is reasonable. It should be some sort of a middle ground. So I hope, in essence, that you do not let the judiciary off with simply an in-out decision without some other considerations being tied that they should make at the trial court level.
The proposal that was advanced by Judge Hargraves was to terminate the judicial role in setting maximum periods of confinement. That's the only change his proposal makes. So the judge will no longer set ceilings within the indeterminate range. The court will continue to have the power to set minimums, subject to the parole board override. Do you have a reaction to that proposal? In other words, it's not really, as I understand and have considered Judge Hargrave's proposal, it is not really to cast the judge solely in a one-out role, because the power of the minimum still prevails. Do you feel there is any virtue in a court set of the maximum period of confinement?
At this point, I do not.
Of a matrix system?
No, I do not. I have no problem with the proposal. What I'm really asking is for at least the salvaging of that part of the task force recommendations, which in essence would pass additional responsibilities so far as findings at the trial court level to the courts. And simply, no matter which direction you go, at least salvaging that portion. But I have no problem with respect to the aspect that you raise.
Now, in terms of detaching that much of the task force report, would you envision that the court's findings would simply be advanced to the parole board for the for their application in determining the actual operation of the matrix to that case, and would be binding on the parole board?
That's right. And in essence, we have sort of an approach being taken by the parole board for those judges who, in fact, follow that sort of a course. They do, in fact, accept those particular factual findings and, in fact, feel that they are made in a form that is more apt to be accurate and proper than in their particular role when they do not have, for instance, the prosecutorial office appearing and being involved in those sort of determinations.
Do you feel there's a right to a jury trial on those issues?
No. You know, I've heard a great deal, too, about the extensive amount of time that it will take. So far as crime severity rating go, this is something that is done with relative ease. I have never had a contested aspect on that particular point. The place that we get into a question is really with criminal history primarily with prior convictions. Of course, the part of the task force proposal two is to back up this process. Of course, what you have to balance off is the additional manpower that it takes to initiate that process at a time which is more rapid than what it is being done now, because now it takes place after the conviction. We are asking that it be moved up. But in essence, I've really not run into any particular problem. Once the bars become acquainted with the application of the matrix and realize that a judge will in fact utilize it and rely upon it in making those sort of determinations, it becomes a very simple process. And for the few of us who have been involved in this and using it on an ongoing basis in all of our cases, making these factual findings on the record, which are simply put out in transcript form and made a part of the judgment order, and in essence go to the parole board, it frees them from a lot of difficulties that they face in trying to review it after it's already passed through the lower court level. And in essence, I just feel it is a much better system, because the district attorney's office on behalf of the public is there too, being represented when these determinations are being made as to actual time to be served.
And you are making these determinations in front of you, also in cases in which you are not yourself appointed to specify the minimum period of confinement.
Yes. Yes, in essence, it's simply, of course, I must admit something that I do, which is a little bit different than what many judges do. I impose minimums as well as maximums, but I impose minimums within the matrix classification, and in essence, I'm giving the parole board a very clear view as to exactly what I feel is the appropriate time and where I'm willing to push up because of findings of aggravation and where I feel it should be pushed down. I would not expect to impose anything of that fashion or that intricate on the judiciary, but in essence, something along that line I simply feel would be beneficial for the process. So if you're going to scrap the whole proposal, consider very carefully pulling some of those aspects out. That's all I'm asking.
Okay. Questions? Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for giving me while you were here. Thank you.
Good morning.
We'll turn to our work session now. First bill is House Bill 2547.
This bill has come before the committee before. In fact, it was voted out. At that time, I accidentally misled the committee because I did not understand one aspect of the bill. I had said before that this was the bill that changed all the filing dates and so forth in the appeals processes to multiple of 7 days. And then when I started to write the measure analysis, I realized there were quite a few critical dates that were not included in this. So I checked the council for the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court. These are the dates that those two levels of the court felt needed to be changed so that they could make the changes in their own appellate rules that they wanted to make. Right now, they are prevented because of these dates in here. And I asked whether it wouldn't be a better idea to wait and change, and if 7 day multiples were a good idea, do it for every appeal date. And the official answer came back that they didn't really think that was necessary, that it was worthwhile to make these changes now unless the bar later in the next interim change the other dates if the parties were interested. So it's back before you again, and I want to apologize and state that this really only covers certain selected appeals dates. And it was amended last time to round up for the next multiple 7 days rather than go down in a couple of cases, namely from 30 to 35 days rather than 28 days.
Is this bill brought on the table by operation of rule?
We reported out.
Not until May 16th, no, it hasn't. It was reported out. I consulted with the chairman on this within right after the meeting as I was writing on it, and that's why it wasn't sent to the floor.
Well, we have in the formal reconsider it.
No.
So if we simply file the committee report, we would be implementing a rather different decision of the committee, but still, unless there's an indicated desire to change it. If we reconsidered and then re-reported the bill, we'd be exactly where we are now.
Right.
Is there any desire to take any different action on the bill? Mr. Chair, file a full report in person for your action. Well, sorry, I'm just gonna...
Mr. Hall, you mentioned the amendment, the effective date, January 1, 1984. We need that amendment.
Yes, I'm sorry, that was also a prior amendment to make this effective on the first of January.
84.
84. The next bill is House Bill 2553. And this and the following two bills are three of the 10 level of 10 bills before the Judiciary Committee. These three were voted out because they had the agreement of both the landlord groups and the tenants groups. I think the committee has handed those two versions of the bills. This first bill, 2553, as it was originally printed, it was to prevent retaliatory eviction for the assertion of any other rights protected by law. It appears that the main purpose behind this bill was to get a complaint by a tenant under some term of the rental agreement, which led to retaliatory eviction, which isn't currently specifically outlawed, that type of retaliatory eviction. So the handed those version basically focuses the bill on that situation where the tenant has complained about a breach of a term of the rental agreement and prohibits a landlord from doing a retaliatory eviction afterwards. And these were amendments were adopted by the subcommittee and before the full committee with the two passes amended recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move 2553 as amended to the floor with two pass recommendation. So according to this, the House Bill 2553 is amended to be reported with the two pass recommendation. Is there further discussion?
Another question. This was looking at the handed those version and just for two of the Republican colleagues who are on that subcommittee, this was the bill that had the rent control going up and three of my Democratic colleagues stayed and we got these out. But I was just looking at the...
You didn't cover for us.
We were... I knew you trusted whatever I did, so I just went ahead and did it. Line 10, the word "of" is underlined and added. And I wondered if that works with the next word in this series. So the tenant has complained to the landlord of a violation of those statutes or of a written rental agreement. Okay, that fits.
You said it's worth it.
Sorry.
No, I'm confused. Are there some amendments you...
Well, I distributed a handed those version with the yellow bill summary. Maybe it's under, they were sent around with pages and I'm sorry if they didn't...
I didn't get it either, so...
Distributed to the Democratic members?
Oh, you know, they may not have distributed them to the two of you because you're on the subcommittee.
Smith didn't get it either.
I didn't get it either. I was cheering.
Well, these were attached to Michael Marcus's testimony, if you have a copy of that, but...
I was the bill again, Mr. Chair. Let me make sure I understand, are the attached amendments, were they adopted by the subcommittee?
Yes. Yes, the handed those version is the version adopted by the subcommittee.
Did I put your motion before?
My motion is pending.
Is there further discussion of the motion to report the bill as amended to due pass recommendation?
Two pins.
Call roll, please.
Representatives Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
O'Hara?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Turner?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Chairman Myers?
Aye.
2554.
This bill also had hearing and work session on April 21st and had the handed those version and I'll pass out my copy to Representatives Lombard and Rutherford. This also represents agreement of both the landlord groups and the tenants groups. It has to do with the case of a building that has been tagged as unlawful to occupy due to building code violations and contains, now that I passed out my version, you don't know what it contains. This handed those version adds a limitation to the that these, a landlord would accrue these damages only if the posting was due to conditions that materially affect health or safety. And we clarified in the testimony that this only is meant to prohibit a landlord from entering into new rental agreements. It's not intended to impose these penalties on a landlord for continuing rental agreement of a present tenant in the building. And then it also deleted the liability of the landlord for paying for the tenant's moving expenses if there was a violation under this bill. The committee also received, or Representative Smith received and distributed a letter from a gentleman who lives in Cambie, Oregon named Paul Ferrer. I reviewed the letter and his main concern is that city housing codes, this would apply both in the case of a violation of the state building code and of a city or I suppose a county housing code. His suggestion was that the bill be limited only to violations of the state building code because there are more procedural safeguards for a landlord to challenge a tagging of a building under the state building code, and some city housing codes may not contain the same kind of procedural due process protections for a landlord. Basically, though, after reviewing his letter and the example that he cited, this will only come into play after it's been tagged by a local building inspector. And I think it's just a question of whether what you think the local inspectors are going to be going too far and tagging the building as unsafe to occupy in matters of materially affect health or safety or not. I guess it's a question of which should come first. Under the bill, the landlord would really have to work to resolve that issue or to get it overturned in the courts before new rental agreements could be entered into. Under his suggestions, it would really be up to the city, I guess, to tag the building, and then they'd have to establish it in court, and then at some point, then it would become illegal. So that's his suggestion, is kind of to turn it around to eliminate violations of city housing codes as something which would trigger these damages for a landlord. In other words, make it legal to continue to rent a building that had been tagged for a city housing code violation. Make that legal to enter into new rental agreements. And make it illegal only if it was a violation of the state building code. And I might mention the state building code really has more to do with the construction of a building than continuing conditions on an existing building. But in any case, the subcommittee voted the bill with the hand engrossed version of the amendments on it to the full committee with the due pass as amended recommendation.
Is there further discussion? Is there a motion on the bill?
Well, I defer to Representative Smith because he did do a very outstanding job as the chair, but he really did, and he ran wide through things incredibly, so I think he should make a motion on this bill, Mr. Chair, otherwise I would start doing it.
Mr. Smith,
yes,
the House Bill 2554 has amended be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
I just might point out to the other members of the committee that Jim Irvine made an appearance on behalf of the Oregon landlords on these three. We had a whole passel of landlord-tenant ones. These were three that he, Mabel DePew, and Michael Marcus all came up together, went through the bills together, and agreed that they had consensus on them. Those are the only three we brought forward. This is one of the three.
Any further? Call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Scalera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Chairman Myers?
Aye.
Bill 2567.
This is the third of the three bills that had the agreement of both the landlord and tenant groups. And again, I refer you to the hand engrossed version of the bill. Lombard and Weatherford. Section 1 by agreement of the parties was deleted. Section 2 as amended deals with Most of the bill deals with the case of a tenant who vacated and has wrongly subleased premises to someone else, with whom the landlord has no rental agreement or any other kind of contractual arrangement, and oftentimes, the first time they learn of a new tenant is when they go and knock on the door to collect their rent or whatever, and there's a new face there. So Section 2 would allow the 24-hour termination of the tenancy for the case of the wrongful sublessee or assignee, when the tenant under the lease agreement has vacated the premises, the landlord would still have to go through a regular FDD process, but you wouldn't have to terminate on a month's notice or anything. Section 4 talks about the burden of proof, assigns a burden of proof to the defendant, generally the tenant, in, as to the question of whether or not the tenant has vacated the premises if there's a sublessee on the property. Section 5 of the bill has to do with property that's left on the property, on the premises by a tenant, and it expands the right of a landlord, after going through all the procedural parts of the act, to sell that property after notice and so forth, and to deduct from the proceeds of the sale both the cost of the sale, which is present law, and also unpaid rent. A new subsection 10 would be added on the tenant side of that issue to provide for certain damages against the landlord if the landlord wrongfully seizes and retains personal property left on the premises. Section, I won't go into it at all, but the other hand, change on the handed version is to basically require service of a summons for an FDD within 24 hours of issuance of it. Apparently, in some counties, the party, the officers who are supposed to serve these things sort of wait until the weekend's up and so forth, and this is intended to speed the process up and make sure that the summons is served within 24 hours of its issuance. But we did clarify in testimony that the summons wouldn't become invalid after 24 hours. This is more directed at the officer serving the process than at either party. And then on, in the latter part of that same section, the time period of 7 to 10 days before the full appearance date was restored, which is what present law is, rather than shortening it to 5 to 10 days before the court appearance date. And this was, also was moved to the full committee with due passing amended recommendation.
Any questions of Mr. Hall or discussion?
There's a agreement.
Mrs. Smith, you wish to do honors again?
I'll move the bill as amended.
Representative Smith, the House Bill 2567 as amended be reported with due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, can we start to move the bill again? The school, the school from the moon.
I have this little note for the chairman right here, says I do not want to carry the landlord tenant bills.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, the, we may have that rule, but it's been broken a number of times, and I was waiting for the members non-carrying request to arrive. I haven't seen it.
We did have Representative Katz and Bauman sponsors.
Oh, two of the bills that we moved on.
Representative Katz has said she does not want to carry the bill.
These are part of the reelection efforts, so. Tell if you like a roll call.
Courtney?
Yes, we're trying to get some things straightened away here.
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Scott Fair?
Nice job.
Scott Fair?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Chairman Myers?
Aye.
2635.
This bill, the payment's not bill. It changes, makes a correction to the textographical error in the evidence code, having to do with allowing extrinsic evidence to require a consistent statement by a witness. Right now, it says it's not admissible unless the witness is not afforded an opportunity to explain. This bill would take out that second not to say that extrinsic evidence is not admissible unless the witness is afforded an opportunity to explain. And this was passed with a due pass recommendation from the subcommittee.
Representative Rutherford moves House Bill 2635 be reported with a due pass recommendation.
Takes it easy.
Oh.
Those important.
Yes.
Hill.
Aye.
Lombard.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Rivera.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Rappert.
Aye.
Chairman Myers.
Aye.
2766.
This bill would establish, would eliminate all of chapter 436, which presently establishes a board of social, state board of social protection. This board was established at one time to allow for procedures for sterilization of a person after petition by two doctors. If the board determined the person was likely to give birth to a retarded or mentally ill children, or children who would be neglected as a result of the parent's medical, mental illness or retardation. The subcommittee heard testimony, including testimony from various groups saying that new procedures were needed to deal with the issue of voluntary consent, or consent to voluntary sterilization and determining the capacity of a person being sterilized to consent or not. That issue seemed bigger and to involve more issues than were warranted to determine at this time. So the recommendation of the subcommittee was that the bill be forwarded to the House with a due pass recommendation and that the various amendments for these procedural aspects of voluntary consent be put into an interim study.
Is there any discussion? Is there a motion? Representative Lombard moves House Bill 2766 be reported with a due pass recommendation. I might say that the attendant recommendation for further commitment of time for interim study will be acted upon by the committee eventually in organized fashion with a letter to go to presiding officers and the chairs, the chair, vice chair, and the committee on the commission. Hold on.
Representative Corbin.
Yes.
Hill.
Aye.
Lombard.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Rivera.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Springer.
Aye.
Rappert.
Aye.
Chairman Myers.
House Chart Memorial 15 and 15, you might as well review both of them.
13 is the Eastern Springs bill, which calls, I better look at it again. I think it calls for rearmament. Well, it mentions the growing threat from various sources and has a list of suggestions to Congress for strengthening our national defense, keeping our guard up. House Joint Memorial 15 is the nuclear treaties memorial, which also makes various recitals about the effects of defense spending on jobs and the budgets and so forth, and recommends to Congress that, I think the key language is recommends a mutual freeze in the testing, production, and deployment of nuclear weapons by the United States and the Soviet Union, and so forth. But two bills had hearings on April 8th. Subcommittee 2 voted both of them to the full committee with, on April 26th, with the recommendation that they be reported to the House without recommendation.
Move House Bill 18 and 15 to full due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Suppose everybody's probably on the bill.
Hold on.
Representative Corbin.
Yes.
Hill.
Aye.
Lombard.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Rivera.
Aye.
Smith.
No.
Springer.
Aye.
Rappert.
Aye.
Chairman Myers.
Aye.
Chairman Lombard moves House Joint Memorial 13 to the floor without recommendation. Further discussion? Hold on.
Representative Corbin.
No.
Hill.
No.
Lombard.
Aye.
Miller.
No.
Rivera.
No.
Smith.
No.
Springer.
No.
Rappert.
Aye.
Chairman Myers.
No.
Chair. Mr. Springer, I move to table House Joint Memorial 13.
Mr. Springer, table House Joint Memorial 13. Call the roll.
President Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
No.
Miller?
No.
Scovaro?
Yes.
Smith?
No.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
No.
Chairman Myers?
Aye.
Table House Bill 2544.
This bill would establish an Office of Administrative Hearing for its own independent director, and basically pull all members of agencies who are presently acting in a hearings officer or administrative law judge capacity into this one office, which would be independent from the agencies whose cases they're hearing. The bill also contains a number of conforming amendments to existing statutes. There was a hearing on the bill on March 22nd, at which time, I believe, the governor's office stated that it opposed the bill and didn't present any recommendations, alternative recommendations at that time. At the work session on April 26th, Subcommittee 2 voted to recommend that this bill be put into an interim study.